All right. Welcome to Free Thinker Radio on the Conscious Resistance Network and in Houston on 90.1 KPFT Houston on the HD2 dial every Monday at 2 p.m. What's going on, Micah?
Oh, man. Just going through all the news as usual. Another week of it. Listening to music. Missing Johnny.
Johnny's not here again. For those of you who tune in regularly and enjoy hearing Johnny, he's not with us this week, but promises he will be back next week. And shout out to Alberta, who is his partner, who's not feeling well. Micah, if you guys don't know, you can still find us. I know you know, Micah, that you can still find us at thehoustonfreethinkers.com if you want to get some background on our show. I need to update the latest archives, but it's got pretty much the latest info that you can find on Freethinker Radio. We've been doing this for 10 years now. Actually, I was thinking about this, Micah. I think it's not even sort of just like vaguely 10 years. I think it's pretty much probably exactly 10 years because if I remember correctly, you know, there was some other show, which I can't remember the name of it at this point, that I had got invited to be a guest on Local Live, a show they had prior to Freethinker Radio. And then they brought both of us on. And I think that was going on for what, maybe like a couple of weeks. And then it kind of became like just clear, like, okay, these guys talk too much. They need their own show. And, you know, we ended up getting Freethinker Radio. But it was sometime, it had to be sometime in June or July of 2011.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I'm seeing some shows. That I know we were already on Freethinker Radio that were 9 years ago. We're steady into that 10 years now. And, you know, I think it's kind of interesting because a lot of things have changed, but things stay the same. We're still talking about freedom, still staying outside the false left-right dichotomy as much as possible, you know, trying to recognize when people fall into it.
Still complaining about some of the same things, unfortunately.
Still jamming, discovering new music, and
Do you think
any of the topics that we're at, we'd be at? Because, you know, back when we started, we were still talking about some of the things we were talking about right before the show here, where there were still kind of, you know, you'd have a Cynthia McKinley and a Ron Paul maybe united, you know, on an issue of like looking at the Fed. You don't have anybody talking about that issue now. You'd have people concerned about the Patriot Act. You didn't have anybody, you know, now you're going to put your mask on or something. I don't know. It's just.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I was mentioning this. So before we started the show, Mike and I started talking and figured we might as well start because this is probably a conversation people would want to hear. But yeah, I was watching some old documentaries, you know, for those who are unaware, in the early days of the 2008, 2009, really the beginning of, I think, the internet as we know it now, which is like social media kind of, you know, uploads, the you becoming the content creator, which is what the point of the YouTube, right? Not like you're watching TV, the tube and somebody else, but you are the tube. That was the whole kind of original idea of that part of the internet. And a lot of the most popular videos at that time were conspiracy documentaries. They were documentaries from Alex Jones. They were Zeitgeist. They were, you know, some of these other films and some more quality and better research than others. But the point is, those were some of the most popular films. And so I just started looking up some old stuff today. And yeah, I found a thing that included Alex Jones and Ron Paul and Cynthia McKinney. And it did remind me that it felt like things were a lot less divided than they appear to be right now. And I will say at the same time, it does feel like there are probably more people asking questions than there were back then as well. You know, because I know when I first started to like wake up late 2009, 2010, and then going into the beginning of this radio show, it definitely seems like we probably are speaking, despite the censorship and all that, speaking to a larger amount of people, or at least people are more open-minded than maybe they would have been 10 years ago. And then at the same time, I will, it's kind of like that. It feels like that in some ways, but then at the same time, it feels like people have kind of been conditioned and accepted everything too, right? Because like you said, nobody's talking about the Patriot Act anymore, or it's just sort of like a rubber stamp. You know, the Fed is no longer an issue. It's just interesting how things have changed, but some things have stayed the same.
You know, when, you know, you kind of took a turn towards some of the positive things that have transpired, or at least empowering things. And I think that might be the case. There are, I guess, various networks that have been working over the last years, different alternative media outlets that have been working, that have developed. And in a way, a lot of them took a hit lately. But if you remember, I mean, back then, everybody had the internet, but not everybody was spending hours on YouTube looking up different ideas of historical events or political events, et cetera, right? Even if they looked up some of it. And so at that time, YouTube wasn't owned by Google. it was, in a sense, what some of these alternative platforms are today. It was an alternative platform. And I think that's kind of what happened, is it kind of went lamestream and became big, got bought up, and, you know, it had to fall in line with the ideas. Since now it's about, you know, controlling ideas, it seems, on every platform that's owned by the majorly, I guess, rich or something. I don't know.
Yeah, the big tech corporations. And I would just put this out there to the audience. This is something we're trying to do more of, is just keep making the show interactive. You know, when we were doing live on KPFT, we were able to have phone calls live on as well as broadcast through the internet. But we don't have that opportunity, but we're still streaming live. And this is going to be recorded and posted on KPFT and on Spotify and elsewhere. So wherever you're listening from, live or after the fact, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Do you think that the fight for liberty is easier today in 2021 as compared to, say, 2011? For whatever reasons, we'd love to hear your thoughts. And like you said, Mike, at the time, maybe even going back a little further, 2008, 2009, I think the internet was more free, more of a wild west than it is now. And I think it's clear to me, this is why there has to be so much censorship, why the big tech firms have to align with the sort of power players that we've talked about over the years, because you can't have a free and independent media talking about these things if you're going to be out there trying to rob people blind and, you know, essentially enslave them. You got to make sure to get that all out of the way, right? So that there's not really much of a challenge. And yeah, you can have them listening to media that divides them left or the right, but you don't want them to have a media that's trying to unite them and inform them and empower them.
Yeah, certainly. And I'm also curious, to some degree, how much the technology creates the space for alternative media, how much people are who create content creators are hungry for the space, so they gravitate towards it, or just, you know, if there's just that much hunger for it, will it always generate new space for itself, such as, like we've said before a couple of times, like pamphleteers and people putting flyers out and posters and just random graffiti artist messages. You see everything from that, you know, to a magazine, you know, that might, you know, back in the days of print that you might read, a subversive book, you know, that might point out some things about the Federal Reserve or, you know, different acts of Congress or the war machine or any of that type of stuff. Like, so now will it always just be, well, I can't say it will always just be, but so now we're in that same mode, but it feels like because people are used to this one device in their hand or their laptop or their computer, they're used to that one thing, they're used to YouTube, that they don't go to the other sources like people might have 15 years ago, who are hungry, knowing they're not going to get it from the Wall Street Journal, you know? So I don't know. I think it's a race between those two things.
Yeah, and I'm happy that we've been able to do it for 10 years and continue to be in that space, because I have definitely seen different, whether you call them podcasts or independent journalists, just different shows and people come and go because of life. And it's cool to be one of the people that can hang on and keep, you know, following along this journey. And it's always cool, people who followed for a long time are still there. I want to remind everybody before we go further and start getting into this news, which is what you're here for, I'm sure, that we are live on Facebook, of course, but want to encourage you to go over to float.app and float.app/consciousresistance, and you can watch live there. You can also watch live on our DLive account, DLive.tv/consciousresistance. And as I mentioned earlier, the archives are always posted on Spotify. They're always posted at theconsciousresistance.com and thehoustonfreethinkers.com. So let's go ahead and dive in, Mike. I know we've got a couple of Houston stories and then some big national news going on, of course, and interesting things that I hope you guys are going to want to hear about and stay informed. Please do give us a like and follow wherever you're watching from. We do appreciate that. This first one is just a kind of a real personal local note. It's here in Houston, but it's also, you might hear us mention, those of you who aren't based in Houston, but watch the show, mention 90.1 KPFT from, you know, from time to time or every single show. And it's because, as we've said, this is the station that we've broadcasted from since 2016. And then on the FM side, I think 2018 going to 2019, I've helped them out with the local news since 2014, 2015. And it's been a station in Houston for going on 50 years. And this building I'm showing you guys here, it's kind of been painted over already. And as you can see on the screen, for those who are watching on the screen, that it is now officially up for sale. So this institution, you know, this Houston's only, as we say, commercial-free, community, corporate-free radio station that has been around for 50 years is now officially up for sale. And so that's why we haven't been broadcasting from the station for, you know, since COVID, basically. COVID interrupted. And then from there, they decided to put things up for sale because the station is in a pretty big debt. It's part of the Pacifica Foundation, which is a network of stations. I think there's only four of them left across the country. There used to be a lot more. The building's up for sale. There is the hopes that we will get into a new building and get back to doing shows, and you know, things are going to continue to broadcast on FM and HD. But yeah, it kind of sucks because I think it's a big change. For those, again, who aren't from Houston, you might not appreciate this, but just think about that local cool part of town that you know in your community, wherever you're from, just what, you know, whether it's a small place or kind of a big area where, you know, the alternative crowd goes to, where's the alternative thinkers. And in Houston, like, the alternative community, including like the LGBTQ community, have always had a space there. But just the alternative community, that's where the tattoo shops are and the alternative bookstores and the restaurants and the radio stations like this all used to be. And obviously, you know, things have changed drastically. And there's more and more signs that the Montrose area where the station is housed, you know, things have just kind of changed for, I think, for the next period. But
I guess the point on here is there's like very, very few vestiges of any of that old spirit left. You know, you could see it occasionally in a, you know, shadow here and there. But I think that's the thing. And they, and that's as far as being last vestiges left. You mentioned it before, you know, and it ties into our whole discussion of alternative media. And for a while, believe it or not, FM was an alternative media. I mean, KPFT and a station that had a you know, delivered commercial free information straight from the DJs and from the community. That was unheard of. In fact, practically, I mean, it was bombed off the air by a hate group. So that says a lot as well. And the one thing I was going to say is that building will, when it goes and that station leaves there, that'll be the last of what was called FM Row here in Houston. And I was just saying how that's the last of FM Row here in Houston. And at one time, you know, alternative media included FM radio. And so all the Houston's FM was right there on that same street. And so speaking of last vestiges, once that building's gone, it's one of those ones that can't, you know, won't come back. And, you know, that's just how it goes.
And they're gonna turn it into a townhome. I just know it. Like a giant monstrosity right there that will fit like four families in there and use up four times the resources and never broadcast anything cool.
Yeah, I mentioned how it had been, you know, bombed off the air by a hate group, more or less. And, you know, I think it's important to think about that. That's how culture changes. And at one time, it seemed like it was valued to have an exchange of information, so much so that all those stations were on the same street broadcasting, you know, et cetera. So,
yeah. Well, just a little bit of Houston, you know, history there, Houston news. I saw others commenting saying that, you know, they think it's sad when a public radio station goes under. So again, whether you're from Houston or not, hopefully you can appreciate, as Micah said, I think it's really important to remember that at one point, even the radio included alternative media because you weren't getting it elsewhere. And now, you know, it's less and less true because of places like iHeartRadio and the big companies that taken over there as well. But let's go ahead and move forward. We got a couple of other Houston stories that we'll bring into, and then we'll be moving on to some national news, including the war hero, the wonderful man, Donald Rumsfeld has died and is
Ronald Rumsfeld.
Yeah, I like that better. Ronald Rumsfeld. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about this comic book story.
I thought that's a fun one. And like many Houston stories, it's indicative of a nation as a whole in a way. In fact, this story, if you notice, it's out of the Miami Herald. So, you know, sometimes we don't even hear what's happening here from our own newspapers. But I thought this was interesting because they basically sued the person who owned the comic book shop, Third Planet. Third Planet's been here since like 75, been through all kinds of hurricanes. And I think you've read a comic book or two, Derek, but and maybe someone out there, speaking of alternative media, comic books, right? So this individual and his lawyer, they filed a complaint against the hotel, the Crown Plaza Hotel, right next to him. And they're a small building, maybe one, maybe two stories, you know. And people would throw things off the balcony onto the roof. Man had already rebuilt the roof once. And one night they threw a whole bunch of fire extinguishers, like projectiles, off the roof. It penetrated the roof. And you can imagine what rain does to a penetrated roof, goes through it, and what it does then to newsprint and comic books that are worth thousands of dollars. And so, you know, every time you would take it to Crown Plaza and try to talk to them about doing anything about the issue, they never took it seriously. So kind of like poking fun at that, his lawyer said, that it's an attempt. They basically created a 23-page complaint that they filed in the court record that is a comic book. So that's kind of a very unique approach to law. They say, you know, they say they're practicing law because it's an art, not a science. And so we'll see how that art goes about. And the lawyer said it's an attempt to use some creative license and a little bit of levity to literally illustrate the serious point, which is corporations cannot dump on local institutions and just get away with it. They will be held 100% liable, he said. If it takes illustrating how to touch the defendant, how out of touch the defendant is, then so be it. So I thought that was kind of an interesting approach, you know, just taking a creative approach to a problem. And it's obviously a very personal approach because it's a comic book shop owner suing, you know, the Crown Plaza Hotel. How much more iconic can you get?
So, yeah, I like the way the lawyer put it there, though. That's important to think about, that it's kind of about just standing up for the little guy, right, and making sure that the big corporations can't just run over people. Yeah, and I appreciate you bringing that. And it's cool because it is a comic book style, like, legal complaint. That's unusual. Well, let's go on to this next story, Mike. I think this is actually a continuation of a story, well, something we've been talking about for 10 years, of course, but just something we were really getting into last week. I'll show, for those who are watching and not listening, you can find our shows on the Conscious Resistance at BitChute, on Minds, on Float, and on Odyssey. And we post the archives, but we also post clips of the shows. As you can see here, I posted a clip of talking about my friend Johnny Hurley getting killed in Colorado, and, you know, the conversation about defunding and police militarization and what choices police should make. So I think that this next story kind of fits in nicely with that, right? Because we've acknowledged on this show and covered for years that there are police violence issues that are taking place and that continue to take place. But some people say the answer is to defund the police. Some people say it's body cameras. Some people say they just need oversight boards. And, you know, I think a lot of times I hesitate to have faith in any of these kinds of things. But tell us about this one, Micah, what this has to do with here.
Yeah, no doubt. We talked about this when, you know, they were, talking about the new suggestions of how to be more accountable to the people and such. But it does turn out that they appointed 7 new members of the oversight board. And I guess they're trying to have just a broad group of people out of society that seem to be, I don't know. We got the CEO of the Houston YMCA. I don't know what all will happen, but they do name the 7 people. They can serve a maximum of 4 consecutive 2-year terms, and they're appointed on a staggered basis. So they hope to, you know, kind of have some change just institutionalized in this board. The board is made up of 21 members. So that's, you know, a new third of the board. And there have been reforms to the board, changes to its charter, establish a new position, Deputy Inspector General. The Mayor's Task Force on Policing Reform report stated, strengthening the role of the Inspector General's office is a crucial way to add independent investigative powers to the review process for police misconduct. So I guess, you know, that's the main thing here, is trying to set up an independent review board. You know, people have argued what that would mean, you know, to be independent. We just passed Independence Day. I asked some people what they thought independence was. So, you know, that this is, you know, one of the, like, as you mentioned, Derek, one of the possible things that are brought up in dealing with police brutality or just abuse of power in general. It turns out residents are now able to file a misconduct complaint directly into their office and submit them through an online reporting system. I'm not sure what difference that will, you know, make. So we'll see over the long haul, but I guess they're just putting it together and they're saying, okay, here's the 7 that we just added and kind of who they are. So it's one of those things, and less of a, you know, yeah.
I don't mean to be too pessimistic about it, but it's like I see this this report you were looking at. It says residents are now able to file misconduct complaints directly with the district attorney's office or submit them through an online reporting system. So it digitizes the thing, makes them a little more easy, which probably should have happened a decade ago. But will that lead to anywhere? I don't know. And again, like you said, whatever they say independent, it's really hard to know what that means. Like, I know that a lot of the activists over the last year who've been fighting for independent review boards and watchdogs and, you know, things like that, they've been specifically arguing for subpoena power, having the power to, like, subpoena witnesses for investigations, because otherwise they're like, well, we can't really do much, you know, if we can't actually get an officer or somebody that has to come testify or you know, be a witness so that during our investigation. So I don't know if I've seen
subpoena records.
Yeah, being able to subpoena witnesses, records, exactly. And I don't think we've reached that point where that's happened. I'm sure it's maybe some other places, but it definitely hasn't happened in Houston. So I think that's important to recognize. Well, I want to play a new song today, Micah, but before we do that, I do want to get into the Ronald Dumsfeld thing and this story, which I think that's now probably going to be his official name. Somebody out there who's creative and wants to print those out on shirts, Ronald Dumsfeld, please do. I'll help with the printing costs to get that. And maybe, like, you know, some stupid picture of him.
What were some of his great quotes? Like, what's he known for?
Well, he's known for this stupid quote about there are things, the known unknowns things. Like, there's things that you know you don't know, and there are things that you know you don't know, and things that you don't know that you don't know. And he's also, I mean, just on a more serious note, he's responsible for, you know, lying about 9/11 in a number of different ways. He was involved in that. Also one of the architects of the Iraq War, which is the first article that I'm printing up about him, because I think it is important for people to recognize it. Look, yeah, I saw a couple of slightly left-wing outlets criticize him, and I saw this piece that I'm about to show here, but for the most part, it's just like, okay, Donald Rumsfeld has died, you know, let's remember him. And I'm sure once warmonger Bush, baby Bush dies, they'll celebrate him too. And it's sickening to me. And I think it has a special place in my heart because this is around the time when I was really just waking up kind of at the first level, when I was getting out of at the end of high school and waking up to the Iraq War and starting to question Bush and Rumsfeld and all that whole thing, you know, 2003 with all these huge protests around the country and the world really against the U.S. going to war over lies. And so that just really is, it's still an important thing to me. And I hate the Bush administration. I mean, I can't stand them at all, and the people that are still out there. So anyways, this one is an opinion piece. I mean, it's really a testimony, I'd say, from Ahmed Twaij, a journalist, filmmaker, and doctor. It says, Donald Rumsfeld pushed for the Iraq War. We should mourn its innocent victims, not him. The former Secretary of Defense will be remembered for the destruction he caused and the lives he ruined. It's a shame justice was never served while he lived. And I'm just going to read like one or two paragraphs, and I will share this link and put it in the show notes once we're done, so for those who want to read it, because I think it's worth knowing, especially if you're in the younger part of the audience and don't really know about Donald Rumsfeld. As is often the case with the deaths of political figures, the memories of their injustices are quickly whitewashed in the name of mourning the deceased and respecting the grieving families. Former Secretary of Defense Ronald Dumsfeld, who died Tuesday at the age of 88, has been no exception. The true tragedy of his passing is that he never faced justice. Following his death, many obituaries have instead been singing his praises. His former colleague, Condoleezza Rice, referred to her good friend as remarkable and a committed public servant. Similarly, Senate leader Mitch McConnell called Rumsfeld one of the nation's fiercest defenders. The lives we should be grieving, however, are the hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis and Afghans who died as a consequence of the push for war that Rumsfeld, aided by many officials in the George W. Bush administration, made following the Al-Qaeda attacks on September 11th, and I put that in quote, air quotes. As an Iraqi, these deaths, several of them friends and family members, continue to haunt me. Without Rumsfeld War, many of them would still be with us. And yeah, so I know you have some thoughts on that, Micah, but you know, what do you think about this, him passing and that usual whitewashing history sort of thing? You're muted.
I think when we have a warmonger up there, you know, pressing and getting media attention, you have people that are, you know, kind of conscious of that happening. And they might talk about it, and they might write even albums about that, you know, stuff like that. But then it seems like after the fact, everybody just forgets about it, and they go play golf with, like, people or something, and then they roll them out, and they're dead, and that's that. I don't know. It seems like a pattern. I don't really have much to say in regard of, I don't have anything to say in regard to that man having done anything good for this country. So, you know, that's just someone who lived through it.
Yeah. And I want to show one more thing about this man, just because I think it's important. We could go all day doing a whole show. Maybe in the future there should be just a podcast on, you know, the crimes of Ronald Dumsfeld. And because this is, here's another one that is a lesser known thing that folks might not remember. Because again, these the whole, you know, I hate the terminology deep state because it's been so associated with Trump. But the reality is there's truth behind it. There's people who are unelected and stay in these positions of power. And even some of them are elected. They play different roles. There is a mechanism. There is an infrastructure there, both inside the system and kind of external or with, you know, outside of it. And people like Rumsfeld are part of that. Dick Cheney, the Bush family, you know, all these folks. And here's just another example. This is from Virginia Tech Undergraduate Historical Review. This is like a publication. And I found this study from
2018. Aspartame controversy. Checking out the quotes coming around. No president has done anything good for other people of this country, no less the people of the world that he used the people of this country to bomb. But that's every president, no exceptions whatsoever. And if you think there's exceptions, it's because you're lying to yourself. You still believe in the puppet show lies. That's from John Swan. So I guess we may have lost Derek. And I have no idea if this is continuing to broadcast and we're recording or not. So we will find out. I'll give him a minute to return. Sure, I can talk to y'all about a number of things. I do think that Ronald Dumsfeld is a fitting name. Did we just never recognize that? So I'm interested in getting to the aspartame controversy of 1981. I know. And Rumsfeld's role. And the FDA. Yep. All right. You hear me? All right. I'm alone, though. I don't want to be here alone. If I was broadcasting, it'd be different. All right, fine. We'll just pretend I am. And I'm just going to go into it. Hey, there he is. I hear another voice. There he is. Yes. Yeah, aspartame controversy.
Yeah, I'll continue. I don't know what happened. My computer decided to freeze up for a second.
Don't freeze again.
But I just wanted to give this kind of final note about another part of his career.
Am I Dumsfeld?
Can you hear me?
No, you're good. You're good.
Yeah, I'm afraid. Okay.
All right, cool. Yeah, you sound good.
Okay, so this is about the 1981 hidden truth behind the not so sweet artificial sweetener. And it's basically an investigation into how in 1977, a Food and Drug Administration FDA investigation into aspartame, which being promoted as this alternative new great sweetener, found that 98 out of 196 infant mice died during this investigation. As they were considering approving it, it was called the Bressler Report, and it showed that the FDA found numerous other troubling data submitted to them by the primary producer of aspartame, the G.D. Searle and Company. And 4 years later, they approved aspartame for human consumption in dry foods. And this is, of course, in diet sodas and all kinds of other products. And so this article, it says that while much has been written about aspartame and its health effects, people haven't really looked into the people involved. And so this one says right here, get to the part I want to read. It says the purpose of this research is to analyze the validity of the FDA's approvals and further investigate the side effects of aspartame. Although numerous studies were conducted documenting negative findings concerning the effects, the sweetener remains legal, partially due to the political power of the companies who manufactured it. Now, here's the key part about Ronald Dumsfeld. In 1981, Ronald Reagan, with the help from members of his transition team, including the CEO of G.D. Searle, which was Donald Rumsfeld, appointed Dr. Arthur Hole Hayes Jr. as the new FDA commissioner. So Rumsfeld's the CEO of this G.D. Searle company, and Reagan puts him on his transition team. And then they help bring in this doctor as part of the FDA commissioner. Just weeks later, Rumsfeld submits a reevaluation of aspartame, and the doctor that they put in there ignores the recommendation of several other doctors and approves aspartame for human consumption. And the article goes into numerous conflicts of interest within the government and big bad business, which allowed aspartame to be approved for human consumption. And it says again, quote, Rumsfeld was able to use political power and connections in Washington to influence key decisions of the FDA in the early 1980s. So, yeah, just a little more history on that dude.
Corporatism. Did you see that? Did you see that, Derek?
It's definitely not the people working together, the people's choice, the people's, you know, goals. That seems to be.
They brought him in. He was the CEO of a private corporation, Searle. He brings him into the president's transition team, right? And then he helps pick the next head of the FDA, head of a bureaucratic branch of the executive government.
And that would be shady enough, like just that. But the fact that he's bringing in somebody based on a choice that, you know, his buddies wanted, but also getting a doctor to go around research that people are finding that is showing some concerning things.
Fast track that stuff. People don't want to give up their sweetener.
We need a sweetener no matter what it, you know, how bad it is for us, even if it puts holes in your brain, which is actually one of the things they did find in these mice studies, is that there was an increase in tumors and holes in the rats' brains and things like that. If you've never looked into that, there's actually a good documentary. I think it's called The Sweet Deception or something like that. And it's about aspartame and this whole situation. So I recommend everybody checking that out. But let's hit a music break before we come back and continue on. Mike, I got a few COVID shots, you know, the vax story. They're going to come door to door. I don't know if you heard old Biden. He says they're coming door to door now. For those of you who don't want to get your shots, you need to convince everybody. So we got that story and more coming up.
Isn't it dangerous for them to get too close to the unvaccinated, though? I'm just saying. Music.
I'm sure they'll have their mask on and their shield and maybe a bodysuit and
tasers, whatever else
they need. And this song is a new one for Freethinker Radio. We haven't played it here. It debuted, I think, 4 or 5 months ago. This is R.A. the Rugged Man and Immortal Technique. I believe it is viewer discretion advised, parental advisory, whatever you want to say. But this is some truth hip hop. And I think it's kind of got a little bit of an attitude that maybe we need right now in this world. So check this out. This is Freethinker Radio. We'll be right back.
I'm the last one they should ever let speak. I should say politics, forget pros, and the Immortal Technique.
Immortal Technique.
Our way of life is under attack. The survival of our friends is in danger.
A new housing plan for the ghetto eventually. Projects for a new American century. False flag terrorism controlling you mentally. The gospel in the hands of people with no empathy. A mixture of dangerous social chemistry between law enforcement and a military entity. Cameras on the corner of every corner you facing. Testing out a future Gestapo on immigration. Power, consolidation, information restricted. Just like the iron law of oligarchy predicted. Incarcerating the poor among the drug addicted. But not the families of the ruling class that's afflicted. Cause it's a fucking caste system like corrupted Hinduism. I think you should listen. I've been through the system in prison. I've been through religion. Carried the cross as a Christian. Like it was anti-disestablishmentarianism. Until the seeds of despotism arrested my vision. Lyricism with cynicism and syllogisms. Until they Pedro Albizu Campos and kill me in prison. Chemtrail conditions, stem cells of Leo Strauss's philosophy. The birth of neocon policy. But I laugh at America's fear of a new world order controlling the hemisphere. Cause my people been living that for the past 500 years.
Intelligence, understanding, the facts they deserve to know. No governmental plan should impose its restraints against your will.
Who can I trust? Expose crimes of the power structure. Enter the fire, cause the truth is now treason to the U.S. Empire. U.S. meddling in almost every foreign election. See where the next drone heading, civilian dead in the Yemen wedding. Barely reported because the weapons were exported from the politicians in the Pentagon. The Saudis bought it and the babies and the children were slaughtered. The authorization, altercation, deployment.
deplorable demoralization, obedience to authority, colonize the minority, social norm is to conform to the immoral majority, white superiority, secession of separatism, the terrorism of American exceptionalism, go to plan B, be free, fuck the TV, fuck the PD, fuck a Tuskegee VD, grave plot, soldier pop, corpse rot, spin over, Monsanto weed killer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, whistleblower, men are afraid to label the threat a traitor, executive legislator trying to suppress your behavior, intelligence interrogator, collecting metadata, condemning the messenger and censoring the educator, CIA feed the propaganda to the television, in the next edition, the pundits preach it in repetition, loyal to the monarchy, hereditary or elected, fuck a royal family and fuck a president selected,
Secret society, the secret oaths. Censorship. Imposing restraints against your will.
Who do we trust? Who do we trust?
The facts.
Who do we trust? Who do we trust?
Intelligence.
Who can I trust? Who can I trust?
Knowledge of intel.
Who can I trust?
Informing and alerting the American people.
What's the cadet motto at West Point? You will not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses. It reminds you of the glory of the American experiment.
All right. Immortal Technique. I'm so glad we could play that. We played Immortal Technique for a couple of different times throughout the show that we've been around, you know, for a decade now. I hadn't heard that song, so that was a good one. I'm really glad you played that, Derek. Thanks.
I like that one as well. It's a pretty cool song. You can find that, guys, at the I think on the YouTube channel of R.A. Rugged Man, R.A. Rugged Man. And Immortal Technique, if you want to check that one out. So these next little few stories here, I think I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. They're all kind of interrelated, you know, talking COVID, talking vaccines. And Micah, I got to bring in like a little bit of a local touch to it because, you know, we're always asking for audience comments and input about our shows and what we're talking about and stuff. And I got some today from another Houstonian. I'm not going to name anybody's names. I don't know if that's necessary at this point, but it just, to me, it's like, okay, this is a comment we got to read on the show. We have to read online and let people hear it. So I'm going to pull that up in just a moment. But before we get there, let's start with the big news of the week, which is that the Biden administration announcing that they are going to be doing door-to-door outreach for COVID-19 vaccinations. Here's a clip from Press Secretary Jen Psaki, I think is how you pronounce her name, from the Biden administration talking about it.
Sort of the technology of firefighters.
Okay, a couple of updates for you all at this top here. After the president is briefed by his COVID-19 response team this afternoon, he will speak to the American people about the strong progress that the country has made in recovery because of its robust vaccination campaign, as well as the importance of every eligible American getting vaccinated, especially as the Delta variant continues to grow among unvaccinated people across the country. By the end of the week, the United States will be nearing 160 million people fully vaccinated, which the president will touch on today as well, which is critically important as fully vaccinated people are protected against the Delta variant. He will also stress how the administration will continue its effort to work with governors, local leaders, and across the public and private sector to get more Americans vaccinated by making vaccines available in more healthcare settings and respond to hotspots. The president will outline 5 areas his team is focused on to get more Americans vaccinated. One, targeted community.
All right. We heard from her enough, I think. But that's kind of the point there is that they're announcing, because they didn't make their July 4th goal of getting 70% of people vaccinated. I don't even know if I trust the numbers they're saying in the first place, but they're saying they were just below it, just missed it, you know, almost America. But now we got to go door to door. We're going to send out the COVID community cores, what they're calling them in Jersey. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. Now it's happening on a national level, Micah. I think this
could take a D and stop this course. I mean, 67%. Ain't that like a D? Can't we just be done?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that I think outside of people's personal opinions about vaccinations or whatever you feel, that it just feels like, I don't know, maybe it's no big deal to some people. They don't mind if, you know, depending on where you live, it might be normal for people to come knock on your door. But I definitely don't think when the government comes to your door, it's usually anything good. And a lot of people, based on what I'm seeing on social media, which might be biased in my circles, right, in my little bubbles, they're like, oh, well, I'm turning on my sprinklers when they come up, or, you know, they're going to be informed about my decisions, which I think is not a bad idea. It doesn't have to be an aggressive thing. If somebody comes to your door and tries to talk to you about vaccines, maybe you should let them know how you feel about those vaccines or about those shots. You know, that might be worth having a conversation about instead of maybe yelling at them, or I don't know. I think things could get a little out of hand for some people just because it's not a good feeling.
Yeah. Oh boy.
I mean, are you going to be opening up the door if you see it's like, hi, Micah, we're here with the COVID Community Corps. Want to talk to you about vaccines?
I just want to know, do you think that there's anybody out there who doesn't know there's a vaccine for COVID available to them if they wanted it?
Sure that there's people just walking around who haven't seen all the ads and all the celebrities and all the, you know,
enticements
and the $1 million lottery. I'm just sure they've totally never even realized or heard of a COVID vaccine. So they need somebody. Oh my God. If you would have never come door to door, I would not have known about this. Thank you so much, Biden. A+. All right. Well, why won't some people take vaccines, right, Michael? Like, let's talk about this, because this is where we're going to shift to. And when I bring in this local Houstonian opinion, you're going to understand why. Last week, we played a clip of Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. We played just a little 5-6 minute segment of his hour and a half press conference that he held, which, by the way, is now on the consciousresistance.com. I backed it up in case anybody wants to see that. You can go and check that out. Full press conference and hear people in their own words. Yes, Ron Johnson is a Republican. Yes, he's from the state of Wisconsin. You might not like Republicans or Wisconsin, but he's not the one speaking. It's the people that
he's
are there.
Senator.
He's a senator. Yeah, I mean, like, whatever reasons you might not like him, and I don't really think I'm a fan of his. I'm sure if I'd look for a moment, I could find something. But he had the courage, or whatever you want to say, to organize this press conference and to shut up and let the people speak for themselves. So it's not him talking for an hour and a half. It's him just saying, hey, I organized this just to get some press. Here's these families. Let them talk to you, right? And that's what happens. And we played that clip last week. And so there are people reporting adverse reactions. There are people paying attention to various studies that are being censored on in the corporate media and in, you know, the mainstream that have concerns. And so that's why they're not in a rush to get this vaccine. It's not because they don't know about it, Mr. Sleepy Biden or Mr. Creepy Biden. It's because they don't want it. I mean, in large cases, I think people are just waiting. And so I'm pulling up a study, an article about a study from our friends at collectiveevolution.com. If you don't like them, go to the study yourself. It's sourced in here. And it says, new study questions the safety of COVID vaccinations and urges governments to take notice. And this is interesting. A new study published in the journal Vaccines by three scientists and medical professionals from Europe has raised concerns about the safety of COVID vaccines, and it's not the first to do so. The study found that there is a, quote, lack of clear benefit for the vaccines, and this study should be a catalyst for, quote, governments to rethink their vaccination policy. The study calculated the number needed to vaccinate, which they call the NNTV, in order to prevent one death. And to do so, they use a large Israeli field study. Using what they call the Adverse Drug Reactions Database of the European Medicine Agency and of the Dutch National Register, the researchers were able to assess the number of cases reporting severe side effects, as well as the cases with fatal side effects as a result of the COVID vaccine. And in the researchers' words, they say that the NETV, which is, again, the number needed to vaccinate, the NETV is between 200 and 700 to prevent on case of one case of COVID-19 for the mRNA vaccine marketed by Pfizer, while the NNTV to prevent one death is between 9,000 and 50,000, with 16,000 as a point estimate. The number of cases experiencing adverse reactions has been reported to be 700 per 100,000 vaccinations. Currently, we see 16 serious side effects per 100,000 vaccinations, and the number of fatal side effects is 4.11 per 100,000 vaccinations. For three deaths prevented by vaccination, we have to accept two inflicted by the vaccination. This is lack of clear benefit. This lack of clear benefit should cause governments to rethink their vaccination policy. So again, let me read that last sentence. It says it, for every 3 deaths prevented by vaccination, we have to accept 2 inflicted by vaccination. This is not a statement by Derek Burrows or Freethinker Radio or Micah Jackson. This is a statement by these researchers and this study and the journal Vaccines. And I will open that up and show you the actual study yourself. But that's, you know, they go on. There's some more points to be made. I do want to encourage you to read it for yourself. But they continue. We need to accept that around 16 cases will develop severe adverse reactions from COVID vaccines per 100,000 vaccines delivered. And approximately 4 people will die from the consequences of being vaccinated per 100,000 delivered. So again, those numbers might not be, I can hear people saying like, well, look, if it keeps the majority safe, yeah, there's always side effects of things, et cetera. You know, and again, they reiterate, simply put, as we prevent 3 deaths by vaccinating, we incur 2 deaths. So pretty clear terms that they're saying. And this is just based on 1 database, 2 databases. One is the adverse drug reactions database of the European Medicine Agency and the Dutch National Register. So just 2 databases in parts of the world. That's not, that couldn't be considered conclusive or complete in any way, but it's definitely a bit of insight into this. And then obviously people have been reporting, Micah, through the CDC's VAERS, Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, up to 4,000 to 5,000, maybe over that, that have been reported. And these haven't been confirmed, you know, where they follow up, because this is the thing, is they have the system in the US, people report their adverse reactions, but then there's no follow-up. So then the media and the people in government can say, oh, that's not trustworthy. Anybody can report to VAERS. But they have never seen a spike as they are seeing now in the reporting of deaths related to vaccines. When you look at all the years of VAERS reporting, you see this huge jump in the last, you know, 6 months or so. What do you think about them, what those researchers said there, though? I mean, it sounds like, do you think, again, do you think the collectivists are going to say, oh, well, 4 people dying out of every 100,000, like?
I would be curious to know the greater stats, but I think it goes back to what we were saying last time that, you know, people pushing for these things, even if just one person is hurt, you know, pushing to make things like this mandatory in any sort of way, you know, it's all well good. And they want to say how, you know, it's safe, only like you even mentioned, only so many side effects happen, whatever, you know, they won't, that argument's wanted to be used, you know, until you see those people, until you think of them as human beings, you know, but you know, this one, they're going to say 3 are saved for 2 that are lost. We're saving one person if it saves one person. So I don't know. I think it's like choosing your poison, because you go from, well, you got a chance of dying from the vaccine, or you've got a chance of dying from this bug, this virus, right? You know, yeah. And what do you want to take your chances with? What do you feel like your body and your history is more equipped with, fighting viruses in this planet or dealing with some newly concocted fast-tracked vaccine? I mean, those are what people are basically being forced to vote, you know, shoot me up with the dangerous chemical, or I'll take my chance on the plague.
I was just looking up this, pulling up the study, Micah, so we could talk about it. And I want to just show like some, a little bit of due diligence on our side, that they're claiming that this study that I just read was retracted within a week or so of the initial, maybe 2 weeks after about a month after it was initially, it was received June 2nd, revised June 19th, accepted on the 21st, published on the 24th. And then it says here, as of July 2nd, a retraction has been issued. And if you scroll through this, you see these letters for those who are looking, it's got retracted listed over all of it. So I open up this one. And it says, retraction, the safety of COVID vaccines, we should rethink the policy. And they say the journal retracts the article. Serious concerns were brought to the attention of the publisher regarding misinterpretation of data, leading to incorrect and distorted concerns. The article was evaluated by the editor-in-chief with the support of several editorial board members. They found that the article contains several errors that fundamentally affect the interpretation. And they're going into some of them here. I don't want to spend too much. Well, they're just saying that they misinterpreted the data. They're saying there are several other inaccuracies, one of which is that fatal cases were certified by medical specialists. It should be known that even this false claim does not imply causation. Further, the authors have called the events effects and reactions, which is when that is not established. And until causality is established, they are events that may or may not be caused by exposure to vaccine. So, I mean, this, honestly, like, so maybe for some people, okay, see, I knew that thing's too crazy. It's retracted. I don't buy it. I don't believe it. But I definitely want to do some deeper research on that for my own kind of clarity on where that's at. But I'm not surprised. Definitely sometimes bad studies get published, and they get published in, you know, crap journals that people pay to get published in. That one is not known to be that. It's a bigger journal on vaccines specifically about that. But it's interesting to me that, like I said at first, it got accepted, then reviewed, then published, and then took a couple of weeks probably of people seeing it out there, and then somebody complained. And now all of a sudden the editor's like, whoops, this one didn't meet our standards, although we reviewed it and published it. So interesting nonetheless.
That's really worth noting. And that's the thing about a print medium, right? You can still obtain the article and do the research. I do think that that's the thing with these things. Over time, they're not going to be able to hide whatever is going to be the truth about it.
Yeah, I think so.
They might try to explain it away.
They could try to explain it away. Well, here's another one, just so people can know that, you know, we're not just, you know, pulling things out of nowhere. This one was published June 29th. Heart inflammation after COVID-19 shots higher than expected in study of U.S. military. This is published by Reuters. It says members of the U.S. military who are vaccinated against COVID showed higher than expected rates of heart inflammation, although the condition was still extremely rare, according to a study released. The study found that 23 previously healthy males with an average age of 25 complained of chest pain within 4 days of receiving the shot. The incident rate was higher than some previous estimates would have anticipated. All the patients who at the time of the study's publication had recovered or were recovering from myocarditis and inflammation of the heart muscle, which is the thing that children have been dying from, teenagers with the AstraZeneca shot. So they had all received that, the Pfizer or the BioNTech, BioNTech or Moderna vaccine shots, experimental treatments, whatever you want to call them. And last week, just a couple weeks ago, some of you might not know this, I know we talked about it, that CDC added a warning to the literature that accompanies the mRNA vaccines to now say that there is a rare risk, they claim, of heart inflammation. But they didn't have that warning before, but now it's there. And this study was published in JAMA Cardiology Medical Journal and said 19 of the patients were current military members who had received their second dose. So that's another example that there are people who maybe have heart conditions that are concerned about that, and they don't want to just jump into the situation. There are people who are checking out the VAERS reporting database and seeing the deaths. There are people who watched the Senator Ron Johnson last week, Micah, and heard that testimony, and they've got concerns, and they're not.
That's it, seems why they, like, the second dose, it's a doozy, it seems like, you know. I mean, a number of these things, it sounded like that second dose. Like, maybe the first one, you just kind of believe. On the second one, you know, you're already committed. You're coming back. I don't know if there's stuff in your body already from the first one. You know, I don't know nothing about this stuff. I don't even pretend to. But it does seem like out of the number of these cases, it's been the second dose that people have been affected by.
Yeah, and there have been reports, I think, that we've talked to some of the ladies in the press conference that I'm referencing as well. Like, we're talking about that. Like, the woman that her daughter, I can't remember her name off the top of my head right now, but the daughter, 12-year-old, who was injured during her getting her shots, she was somebody who, like, okay, I got the first shot and had some kind of intense reactions and then went back for the second one, and it just compounded things. But I've also talked to people who went to get their first shot, and they had an adverse reaction that scared them a bit. Like, you know, not just, oh, like they say, you'll have some redness and some swelling on your arm, but other things that were enough for them to say, forget that, I'm not going back for the second one. So, you know, Micah, we covered this, like, Biden administration is going to go door to door now. They're saying, we don't know what that looks like exactly yet. But that was after we talked about how the state of New Jersey was already announcing a similar program. Seems like that's going to be one of the next steps, going door to door, trying to find who's vaccinated, who's not vaccinated. We talked about heart inflammation in a military study, as well as in teenagers with the AstraZeneca shots. This other reports of vaccine, you know, adverse reactions. And then here's, I'm showing on screen.
They got religious people that go door to door, right? They got religious people. If y'all mm-hmm. used to dealing with those people, maybe we can apply some of those skill sets to these people. You know, it's really the same thing. They're trying to persuade you to believe their way, you know.
Believe their cult. Yeah, I think so. The COVID cult is one. But so this right here, what it was showing again is a clip. Like, these are people for an hour, not the senator, whatever you feel about him, but these women testifying. And this mother right here testifying about how her daughter and her were affected by the COVID shots and all the things that we just went over, Micah. And then now I'm showing on screen for those who are looking on screen. And if not, I'll just say it for those who are watching. We got a local Houstonian guy. I'm not going to say his name, but you see it, Micah. I think you probably see it on screen. And he says, this is his response to me posting literally just a video. It doesn't say anything. It just says on June 28th, Senator Ron Johnson held a press conference featuring families speaking about adverse reactions from the COVID shots. Simple, which is all it is. And he says, anti-vaxxers are a-holes. The anti-vaxxers are an adverse reaction. They define reactionary. And, you know, I said to this person, like, is this literally your response upon hearing people share these stories? I mean, because I've seen this person communicate online in a hyper-partisan way. So I'm not too surprised, but it's just like, okay, this is beyond partisanship. This isn't like a Republican convention. You know, this is just like people, testifying. Here's another comment from the same person. I think it's great that you amplify the most reactionary voices in government to make your point because it lets everyone know what a tool you are. And this is video, again, isn't amplifying the, I don't know if Senator Ron Johnson is a reactionary voice or anything about him much, but this isn't, again, like I said, it's not about him. I think he speaks for the first 2 minutes of the press conference and then the rest he hands over to the people who are dealing with these adverse reactions. But I just, you know, after everything we just went over, everything we've covered on the show, Micah, and like you said, you don't have to be a scientist or a doctor. Neither of us are, of course. But when people just dismiss things like that, just like, oh, you're an anti-vaxxer, of course. Where did that come from? Like, we're talking about a study with myocarditis increases in military members and talking about people who are having adverse reactions to, and, you know, somebody studying the numbers in Europe and finding, you know, just, yeah. And that's reactionary. That's.
Well, once you've defined your virtue by taking this product into your body, you know, twice, you know, you've received the message of the cult in your body twice there. It's really easy to think that, you know, you've got something better than all those other unwashed masses of non, you know, benefited people or whatever you want to say.
The other thing it makes me think of, so this will be my last article here on COVID, and we're going to talk some economic news. I know we got some interesting financial stuff to cover, and then I've got a couple of surveillance stories I want to hit before we get out of here. And then, you know, maybe if we have time, maybe we'll save it for the next show. I wanted to talk about the Patriot Act Part 2 that some people might not be aware of from all the way back in 2003 and maybe where we're headed. But we'll see what we get into today. Of course, you're listening to Freethinker Radio. We do this every Wednesday. You can find us on theconsciousresistance.com. The archive's there. You can find us on thehoustonfreethinkers.com. We broadcast live on Wednesdays, and then it is broadcast on Monday afternoons at 2 p.m. on 90.1 KPFT at kpft.org. So this story, it's just a short one. It's from The Economist, and they got some snarkiness in there about the way they describe people. But I thought this was interesting. It says, the anti-lockdown movement is still going strong. This is published in the latest Economist magazine, and it's specifically the British edition. So it's kind of specific to that, but I think it's interesting. It says, quote, it has united the anarchist left and the anti-establishment right. And they're just talking about how, you know, back in the day you had the Occupy movement, you've had these different types of movements, and now these supposed anti-pandemic opponents, anti-lockdown opponents are made up of conspiracy theorists, people against Bill Gates, but also people who are like against the disenfranchisement of people that has happened under lockdowns. And just, yeah, so it just goes into a few examples of how left and right and center and maybe people beyond descriptor could be finding ways to work together, which is, again, like we were saying at the beginning of the show, Micah, 10 years ago, it seemed like there was more unity, more opportunity for that. I don't see that so much now, at least in the U.S., but it's interesting to hear this perspective. And I know that the gentleman I was just showing that had the anti-vaxxers are a-holes comment, he's definitely somebody's on the radical left, I'm sure he would describe himself as. And to me, I see opportunities where somebody like that, or, you know, just kind of using him as a stand-in for anybody that's in a different position than I am, that we could probably find somewhere to work together when it comes to these issues. But if you just have a reaction to somebody and say, hey, well, you're talking about things that people say aren't good, well, you must be this crazy thing, so I can't work with you.
Well, that's all by design. A tool and an a-hole. That's what he had. He didn't have an argument about it. He didn't have, look, but I read this and I believe this source is more credible, you know? Or you say what you will, Derek, or you're supporting the senator. So, you know, he could at least have something to say rather than people that I clump in this big, broad-reaching term, which we've talked about, that whole phrase, anti-vaxxer, being a fundamentalist term used by fundamentalist, you know, people, and just, you know, resorting to calling names. He didn't provide any argument. And I think that says a lot right there.
Yeah, I think that is important. And that's what Freethinker Radio is about. I mean, honestly, I wish and I hope that person that we were just showing or anybody who feels critical about what we're talking about that is watching the show or listening to this would want to leave a comment, would want to hop in. Look, if you're around, we could, you know, bring you on the show. We could do live questions. Let's have a discussion because that's what Freethinker Radio is about. Critical thinking, individual thinking. You know, it's what the show's been about for 10 years now and will continue to be about. So let's go ahead, Micah. Let's move forward. I know I had a long section there, some COVID news, just kind of getting people caught up. But there's also some interesting economic things going on. And I know you had two stories, one related to the Fed, one related to Venezuela.
I just know that.
Yeah, let's get into it.
I know that in the face of all this stuff, I even looked up the Fed and it said, three articles were about how they're concerned about the Delta variant and inflation, you know? So I was just like, we have to have something else to talk about, you know, just to bring the Fed back into relevance besides all the stimulus that's going on. And I thought this one was kind of interesting here. And it's saying how much the Federal Reserve is actually getting back into mortgage-backed securities. And it's just got a brief moment here. And the article asks the question, why again is the Federal Reserve adding $40 billion a month to its holdings of mortgage-backed securities? When the mortgage market doesn't even need doesn't need assistance. The Fed, it turns out, bought 47% of the net issuance of mortgage-backed securities in the fourth quarter. I just wanted people to kind of just the facts in this little article were interesting, you know, to think about the Fed buying almost half of the mortgage-backed securities of an entire quarter. Well, anyway, if you go by its $120 billion quarterly increase in holdings and the SIFMA figures that show that the total outstanding mortgage-backed securities grew by $257 billion. So I don't know. I don't think anybody imagined, you know, that when they start thinking of the Federal Reserve and they don't, obviously, I think most of our listeners know about the Federal Reserve, but I'm not sure that the mass of population does yet. And I don't think that they do consider how spending $40 billion a month in the, you know, mortgage securities is affecting the market, you know? So I just, I wanted to bring something from the Fed affecting our world that was something other than them just, you know, the print and mandrake mechanism. And
well, let me ask you about this, Micah, because I'm kind of slow with this stuff. So I know what the Federal Reserve is. Obviously, like you said, most of our audience will be familiar with that. But what specifically is a mortgage-backed security? Like, is that meaning that they own people's debt for their houses?
Yep, that's exactly what it means. So, you know, you may have bought your debt through, I mean, obviously these people who worked with the government and Freddie Mac and Jenny Mae, Fannie Mae, those sort of things, they know that they're already messing with those people. But some people may have had a Capital One mortgage or this or that mortgage that got sold on to another distributor that eventually got packaged up with 15 other mortgages and bought somewhere where now somebody's 401k is investing in, you know, the returns on your mortgage. But yeah, so the Federal Reserve, that thing that people sometimes forget as a private enterprise, is buying up mortgage-backed securities. And guess who owns those securities, you know, when people can't pay, you know, should a depression or, you know, a massive recession like we've been on the edge of and may not have really, I don't know whether we're totally out of it or not. There's a lot of diverse data on that.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's interesting, though. I mean, I think it's definitely never a good position to be in where the banks, the private banks, which are the ones who run the Federal Reserve, because again, reminder to anybody who's not familiar, the Federal Reserve is not federal and it holds no reserves. It's not, you know, it's this quasi-private, whatever, quasi-governmental monstrosity, public-private, right? And it's run by the bankers, you know, the bankers that have been involved with so much of this. Those are the same people owning your homes.
Exactly. And you're empowering these people if they're holding a note on your home. The other thing I wanted to bring up here, and we don't have time to get into it in this episode, and I probably could have prepared for that better, but we've been hearing about BlackRock buying more and more entire neighborhoods and even paying, you know, above market rate to buy up these houses and then just turning them into large rental places. And we think about these warnings coming from the future, whatever you want to say, you'll own nothing and be happy. Yeah, with the Federal Reserve and their proxy BlackRock buying up the country, I don't know. I think there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Actually, as soon as you were bringing that up, I had just thought of that. So I was pulling up, let me pull up a couple articles because there's two different perspectives here. And this one says investment firms aren't buying all the houses, but they are buying the most important ones. And this is in reference to what you were talking about, Micah, with BlackRock, who, again, BlackRock was a big player in the COVID-19 relief. They got lots of money. I mean, there's another bailout, right? Another big bailout for BlackRock. And what was the other one? There's two of them that we were kind of confused about, but they both serve similar roles, BlackRock and then some, I can't remember the other one. Vanguard is another one that people pay attention to, but these firms are buying up housing. And yeah, like you said, if they're the folks here who are connected to the World Economic Forum, the Great Reset push, all that, if they're telling you you're going to own nothing to be happy and they're buying up all the homes, they're buying up all the home debt. I don't know. Maybe we should pay attention, but, yeah, let's jump into Venezuela, Micah. What's happening over there?
Yeah, I thought this one was just kind of interesting in general, because, you know, we see this whole, I think it's similar to that minimum wage argument, like the number, once it's fiat, once it's just arbitrary in that manner, people might not know what we mean by that, but meaning that there's nothing it's tied to, at least, you know, if you traded me a loaf of bread, that I can make sandwiches, you know, it has a certain value, it has a certain use. But when it's just a piece of paper that they've added zeros to, or a chip that they've added more, actually not a chip, that'd be worth something, right? But a blip on a chip, then, you know, that they've added an extra keystroke to, what value was there? But let's just leave those questions in the background and look at Venezuela, because now they're talking about slashing 6 zeros from their currency to better facilitate payments. And when you see how many bolivars it now takes to equal a dollar, you'd probably understand it as well. This is not the first time Venezuela's central bank will have taken such a measure. In fact, citizens have already gone through this process twice. The first event of monetary reconversion happened in 2008, and it slashed 3 zeros from the bolivar. So that's like taking $1,000 and turning it into a dollar. At that moment, the country was in a very different situation, with interannual inflation of only 20.44%. The second conversion was applied not so long ago, in 2018. So just, you know, 2-3 years ago, it deleted 5 zeros from the currency. So that's like taking $10,000 and saying that is now $1. This time, Venezuela was in dire straits, facing a hyperinflationary process and the start of sanctions that would impact economic development. Around that time, the government launched Petro, its official cryptocurrency, as an attempt at countering this situation. This means that in less than 15 years, Venezuela will have slashed 14 zeros off its currency. But without any effective measures to counter inflation, this, of course, is simply a Band-Aid for some citizens affected by the current situation. And, you know, it's hard to understand how anyone can ever, I guess it's kind of like, how do you put it? You get numb to something over time and it takes more and more of it. So, like, how does this work? You know, they say that some of the reasons they want to drop it is it makes it easier for online transactions, that right now the bolivar trades at approximately 3,200,000 bolivars per dollar. I mean, that's 3,200 bolivars per penny.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I've seen a few journalists go out there and kind of just experience what's happening there with their currency. And I mean, this latest development you're sharing here isn't going to help anything at all.
One last note on that. The highest note that they have, the highest coin note they have, is 1,000,000 bolivars, and that's 30 cents. It's used for bus fare.
Wow, Jesus. Yeah, man, that's scary. I mean, I know there's folks, especially those who have been watching us and tuning into our work for the last however long that are aware of things like the Federal Reserve, which we just covered, and hyperinflation that could come as a result of policies like this we're seeing in Venezuela. And people are concerned that that could happen in the U.S. And I think people, in addition to the COVID worries and the all the other worries, oh, they're talking about the aliens, and they're talking about, I mean, it's so crazy. Like, that's a thing on mainstream. They're talking about the aliens, they're talking about the inflation, they're talking about the Delta variants, and they're talking about the climate. You know, it's just like so much happening right now that people are looking and I think expecting some sort of cataclysm coming soon. And this,
they never talk about good. They don't really talk about good happening. What's up with that?
We try to talk about some good when it's around there, and maybe we'll remember to get to that before we wrap up today. But this one, I wanted to continue our economic conversation. I don't know if you had a chance to look at this. This is I just came across it the other day. I'm not sitting here to say I vouch for this site. It's called The Daily Reckoning, or I don't know much about the guy. His name's James Richards. Apparently, he's, you know, one of these economic types like Gerald Celente and others who, I don't want to say make predictions, but have analysis, you know, and they put it forward. And this one is called The Great Reset is Here. Again, I'm not going to read the entire article. I will post the link. It's from the Daily Reckoning, or just dailyreckoning.com. There's no the, dailyreckoning.com. And he's talking about the Great Reset. And he's talking about, you know, this being the next Bretton Woods moment, which we heard announced in the last couple of years by the global economic elite. He goes into some points here. He says, at a recent G7 summit in the UK, G7 leaders gave their blessings to $100 billion allocation of IMF special drawing rights to help lower income countries address the COVID crisis. So again, SDRs or special drawing rights, this has been something that different researchers and analysts have put forward, said, hey, this is kind of a skeleton or a precursor to a global currency, a one world reserve currency that's not the US, that's some new thing that most likely digital, and that people have, again, for different reasons, feared. And so here it is, the G7 leaders agreeing to give a blessing to $100 billion of IMF special drawing rights, which again is kind of like an alternative to the dollar. Biden fully supports the idea. The White House issued a statement saying that the US and our G7 partners are actively considering a global effort to multiply the impact of the proposed special drawing rights allocations to the countries most in need. And a potentially up to $100 billion in size, the proposed effort would further support health needs, including vaccinations. And they also said, we strongly support the effort to recycle SDRs to further support health needs. So it's being put in that terms of like, this is going to be COVID relief funds. This is like the international central banks. I don't think we should trust what they're up to in the first place. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva said Wednesday, she expects the funds to be approve a the governors of the IMF to approve a $650 billion allocation of SDR in mid-August. And so they go, he says, what exactly are they? Basically, they're world money. In 1969, the IMF created the SDR possibly to serve as a source of liquidity and alternative to the dollar. And it goes into the devaluing of the dollar in relation to gold. And, you know, says that the IMF issued special drawing rights in 1970, but they didn't do any between 1981 and 2009. There was none of these issued. And in 2009, they issued some. And he says, because zero SDRs were issued between 1981 and 2009, the IMF wanted to rehearse the governance, computational, and legal processes for issuing the SDRs. And basically, he's saying now they're back and they're ready to kind of start issuing these. And he's proposing that this is part of a push towards the Great Reset, kind of a global government, if you will. And I'll just read this final statement here. He says, I wrote about SDRs and the global elite plans for them in the second chapter of my book, The Road to Ruin. Over the next several years, we will see the issuance of SDRs to transnational organizations such as the UN and World Bank for spending on climate change infrastructure and other elite pet projects outside the supervision of any democratically elected bodies. I call this the new blueprint for worldwide inflation. And he says below, and I guess he goes further, he says, in the next one, I'll show you why the weaponization of the dollar by the US government is pushing the world to seek alternatives, including the SDR. So they're basically saying the SDR is going to be a precursor to a global currency as per the World Economic Forum and their push for the Great Reset and kind of resetting, remaking all the systems, including the economic systems. You familiar with that, Micah, the special drawing rights thing, the IMF?
Vaguely. That did a pretty good job of covering it, but I've never really understood how it works as a money, but I've understood that it was a money, you know, that's actually competing with the dollar, and you know, I did not know that it'd been around since 69, so that was kind of informative as well.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Like I said, it's at thedailyreckoning.com. I will share that link to everybody who wants to read it. But
I think it creates this situation, I guess, where some people, we ought to dig more into this one too. We ought to put notes on some of these. We need to dig more into this one because I think it creates a situation where only, like they were saying, only these elites are able to access this money and use the power that's there, and not like the, for lack of a better word, democratically representative or whatever you say, the government of the people, if there is such a thing.
I thought it was also interesting because they said that these would be like granted by transnational organizations like the UN and the World Bank, right? So it's like they don't even have to go to governments anymore. If these SDRs get accepted as they already are as kind of like a currency and it becomes more valuable than the dollar, then people stop trading things in the dollar and, you know, or other currencies altogether, and everybody starts using these SDRs. And so you can go around governments, like they're saying, like non-elected bodies that are just issuing currency for projects about climate change and whatever the heck they want. And I mean, I don't know. It definitely doesn't seem like anything more free.
Yeah, it's hard to know, but it is interesting, you know, Bitcoin, gold, silver, those sort of things going around, you know, governments in that way, as far as having a money that's separate from a Federal Reserve note or a British pound or whatever you might think of.
Yep. I just got a couple more stories, Mike. I think the discussion on the Patriot Act that I wanted to have, maybe we can save that for the next one. It's already been at this for an hour and 15 or so. It's getting a little late over here, but I do want to hit these last couple headlines. I appreciate everybody who's been tuned in. Thanks to everybody who's watching on Float, who's watching on DLive, those who are going to be watching after the fact on BitChute, Odyssey, Minds, Hive, Rockfin, etc. And of course, everybody on Facebook, we appreciate you, but consider watching on these other platforms or following us on Spotify. So there was a big settlement that took place, big settlement, right? Big news. But unfortunately, with the settlement means that nobody is being charged or held responsible at all. Boy Scouts reached $850 million settlement with sexual abuse victims. Several victims' attorneys blasted the proposed payout as inadequate and demanded more transparency from local councils as to what assets that they hold. And this is a case that I know we've talked about over the years because it's been going on for a while. But this past Thursday night, there was a settlement in bankruptcy court for $850 million with over 84,000 former scouts saying that they were sexually abused as far back as the 1960s. 84,000 former Boy Scouts saying they've been sexually abused as far back as the 60s, 60 years ago. So that's crazy and not cool. And the 100-year-old Boy Scouts filed for Chapter 11 protection last February as it faced an avalanche of lawsuits claiming abuse by adult scout leaders and volunteers. They say the settlement resulted from months of mediation by different parties. But again, there are people who are critical of it. And I would say, you know, like, yeah, maybe some of the victims chose to go this route. Maybe they're like, look, if this ever goes to court, you know, it's not going to get anywhere. It's going to be messy. They convinced them one way or the other. There are people in the Boy Scouts as well. But again, nobody's been charged. This kind of it's just like the freaking Vatican, Micah, and like the church and stuff. It's like, okay, they let the Boy Scouts just sort of internally handle it. That they, because, you know, we covered this before too, that it was revealed that the Boy Scouts, they weren't just clueless about this. They knew this was going on. They, in fact, had their own kind of like special unit or division within their organization that dealt with these kinds of cases, and they had been covering it up. So they had covered up cases when people would try to report them. So, I mean, it's just sickening because, you know, you covered this a lot, Micah, before, specifically about the schools, how the kind of child abuse that's prominent in schools and security officers and things like that. We've talked about the Epsteins of the world and the Harvey Weinsteins and the, you know, all the other power players involved in that and the Kevin Spaceys and just the whole, how this issue exists. And it exists in the Southern Baptist Church and the Jehovah's Witnesses. And now it's in the Boy Scouts and it's in the White House call boys. And it's just, you know, it's a thing. It's happening here. And 84,000 people who felt comfortable enough coming forward, right? Maybe those numbers aren't even really accurate. I don't know how they counted them exactly, but what do you think about that, Micah? Obviously, it should be up to the decision that a quote unquote victim or abuse survivor just wants, you know, if they want to go after them or if they want money, I guess. But
I'm kind of, I think what it ought to show is how rampant this abuse is in a way. Let's think about it, like, separate from the whole what the Boy Scouts are, you know, and the types of, how do you call it, almost people can ridicule it in a sort of like it's a little military attempts or whatever, you know. But I don't know. I think there's a lot of people in the Boy Scouts. I think it's a very open organization to their defense as far as how easy it is for people in the neighborhood to become volunteers and stuff like that. And being a very open organization of any type, you open yourself up to, you know, abuse under your flag, under your name, you know. And so I think that kind of just a problem with their system separate from what's done with it. And I do think that there's something about rust and perversion that wants to go into anything that could appear to be beneficial or empowering. So it would want to go into all these religions. It would want to go into the cops, the Boy Scouts. It wants to go into everything. I think that's just an aspect of it. So I'm not surprised. And, you know, we're in these decadent times. So the fact that this has been going on for 50 years, I bet it's been going on for 60, 70 years, because like I said, I think the Boy Scouts is a fair cross-section of society. I don't think everybody and every demographic is represented well in the Boy Scouts, but I do think a lot of people are in there. And so if you've got that many people, if you look at that number, 850 million divided by 84,000, you're talking about $10,000, $11,000 or something worth of, you know, as if money can make up for that. But I don't know. I don't know. I don't think you can. Crimes are crimes. And if you've got an organization that's allowing an individual or trying to hide that an individual is abused or violated, you know, anybody, then you need to question that organization right then. You know, does it represent the values it says? Because most good, empowering organizations have some values that they're pretending or saying they represent, and they have to hide this stuff away, right? They have to, because it's in conflict with what they're selling, with what they're professing. So I think they need to be called on it. And you know what bankruptcy is? It's typically just a way for rich people to get richer. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. I hope that there's some kind of justice and that people who suffered in those ways find some kind of solace in what's happening. And hopefully more will come forward. Maybe there will be more information to come out in the future. I just want to hit these last two surveillance headlines. There's just, you know, just things coming and going this week that maybe you care about, maybe you don't. We'll see if anything comes of it. But a couple of politicians introduced a bipartisan legislation to require warrants for government use of Stingray phone surveillance. This is actually a couple of weeks ago. I've just been meaning to get into it. And the reason is, for those who follow Freethinker Radio and some of my work, and I've been investigating stingrays for a long time, specifically in Houston, helping expose that HPD was lying about their use of Stingray cell phone surveillance tools. They're also called cell site simulators. And this was back in 2012, 2013, 14. And they're pretty widespread all over. All the federal agencies have them, local agencies. They can get your pictures, your texts, your calls, the length of the call, lots of different things from there. And they're just, they're totally, I don't know if regulation's the answer or if government should even have them at all, but they're just, it's just kind of a Wild West area of law. And so they're putting together this bill. They're calling the Cell Site Simulator Warrant Act, and they're saying it will put an end to overlapping, confusing policies and laws at the federal, state, and local levels by creating clear legal standards for the use of cell site simulators by any government agency. And Senator Ron Wyden said, quote, cell site simulators exist in a kind of legal no man's land for far too long. Our bill ends the secrecy and uncertainty around stingrays and other cell site simulators and replaces it with clear, transparent rules for when the government can use these devices. It also says the Cell Site Simulator Warrant Act gives law enforcement the tools it needs to investigate crimes while ensuring that Americans' rights are fully protected. So, like I said, it's just been introduced. I actually looked it up on some of the, like, you know, the GovTrack and Congress and some of the other ones, Micah, where they sort of rate like the percentage of the chance of the bill being approved or passing. It said like this bill has like a 4% chance of passing or going anywhere. But hey, good on them of trying to introduce this thing. And they got a couple of people from both teams.
Isn't it so weird that a bill that you don't see, you wouldn't think there'd be too many people like, who's against this bill? That's
The cell site simulator industry.
I guess that's 96% of the power, huh?
Well, yeah. Harris Core was with a company. I think they recently renamed themselves. I had to look it up. And there's a few others that I've researched over the years, but they're definitely pretty powerful. I mean, they sell to militaries, they sell to governments, they sell to local law enforcement. So I'm sure they do have some weight, you know, and yeah, we'll see if anything comes of it. But to add to that, there was a report. I'm actually working on a longer article for later this week, kind of an in-depth piece about like what this means in the larger picture of facial recognition, because facial recognition is something that really scares me pretty strongly, as far as just the power of it and the power to take away freedom and privacy, which already exist. You know, if you go to a grocery store, a lot of them in the U.S., I noticed when I was back in Houston, Micah, at like maybe HEB or a couple other places, like, you walk in and it's kind of like you're staring at a webcam when you're trying to check out at the thing. You can't like check out without like, I'm trying to like shop and check out with like avoiding the thing so they can't see my face because it's just staring at me and it's on a big screen right there. And I don't know, this stuff makes me uncomfortable. And there have been plenty of smarter people than I and more informed technologically folks warning about this for a number of years. And this is just one of the latest warnings coming from the Government Accountability Office. I searched for this to see if anybody talked about it, Micah. I found one article on CNN, one article on Washington Post, and in some other obscure tech website, and that's it. And that was July 1st. So it's been a week, and people have already moved on. But according to the GAO, the facial recognition technology has already been widely used across the government for years. Surprise, surprise. Another area where there's really no kind of limits to what the government can do about it. And so it says that, according to a report released on Tuesday by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, based on a survey of 42 federal agencies, that agencies have used facial recognition software from May to August, just 3-4 months in 2020, to support criminal investigations related to civil unrest, riots, and protests. The U.S. Postal Inspection Service, for instance, told the Government Accountability Office that it used software from Clearview AI, which is a very controversial facial recognition company that I've talked about. I've written articles for The Last American Vagabond. You can find more about that on The Conscious Resistance. Just another one of these crazy companies that is out there selling, has a huge database selling to governments and to, I think, just the highest bidder. And so this report is just talking about how, yeah, there's a lot of private agents. There's a lot of agencies. It says 20 federal agencies use or own facial recognition software between January 2015 and March 2020, including the FBI, Secret Service, ICE, Capitol Police, Bureau of Prisons, and the DEA. In addition to monitoring civil unrest after George Floyd's death, it says the report indicates that three agencies used the technology to track down rioters who participated in the attacks on the Capitol in January. And it just goes on to describe how there's a lot of examples of this. 14 agencies told the Government Accountability Office they use facial recognition technology from outside the federal government to help with criminal investigations. And 13 agencies do not have up-to-date complete information because they're basically not required to keep it or track it, or, you know, so they could just be using it indiscriminately. And they go into here describing more examples of how they're using the internet as well as facial recognition tools, along with surveillance tools like the Stingray we were just talking about that these politicians are trying to get rid of. They use that to monitor you in your face, follow you everywhere you go, and store it for the future. Who knows, right? Because I mean, that's the big thing, right, Micah? It doesn't really matter if you're not doing anything now illegal, but maybe in the future, I think that they're just going to backwards mine all the stuff that we've been putting online and cataloging for the last 10, 15, 20 years. And in the future, it might be pulled up like, hey, well, we have your digital record in 2008. You said this subversive thing on Facebook. And well, now it's going to cost you some social credit points.
Yeah, for sure. And they'll know who you are when they come door to door to recommend you join their club. Yeah, that's it. They'll be like, we've heard of you. We know your views. We know everything. So
just you're already on the list.
Comply. Yeah, that's why we're here.
And you know. Yeah, I mean, just the lists are real, right? People joke about like, oh, I think I'm on a list. Like, no, there's the no-fly list. There's the domestic terror watch list now that's increasing. There's all these kinds of things. And you have this apparatus with facial recognition cameras. You got the stingrays, you got the door-to-door shot salesman, you got the, you know, all this stuff coming together. It seems like some of the things us and folks way before us have been warning about for a while is right in our faces and staring at us, Micah. But really, you know, we're just reactionary a-holes.
Tools.
Just tools. But anyways, guys, it's been a good show. Thank you for listening this week. I think I'm pretty much done for today, Mike. I think I've said everything I need to for this week. But
for sure,
hope everybody will find us on Spotify and, you know, find us on the HoustonFreethinkers.com and KPFT, wherever else you can, and share the show with your friends. We appreciate you guys for being here with us and thinking.
No doubt. We had some good comments go by. I've really enjoyed what I've seen. And I always enjoy spending the time talking about the news and some of the solutions and such. So thank you, everybody, for allowing us to do that. And like Derek said, hitting all these other sites and keeping the conversation alive, not just with our show, but with other shows and what's real going on. So thanks for doing that and caring about the world. Till next week, Derek. Take care, man.
Take it easy. We're going to end with some El Jumbotron, Nature's Revenge. We'll see you next week for Freethinker Radio. Peace.
Here's a short story about a dying hollow. Hands of the